All righty. I reckon that's it. Okay.
I am informed by Professor Eit, Laura Eit, that, let's see, you can get big for me. Oh, there we go. Her next lecture, which will be the next week, apparently we have got, oops, no, this is wrong. This is... Okay. Poussin. Oh, this is supposed to be... Okay, so it's in the wrong week. I need to change those around. Oh, wait a minute. No. She said she's putting something up. Where would that be? Or did she mean she put things up? I thought she was going to put something up here, unless she meant she had put something up in her previous lecture, which was the lecture on the Dutch painters. But I'm not sure what that would be. I'll have to check with her. But in theory, there's something that she has or will put up that will be something for you to look at in connection with the lecture for next week. That is all I know. Otherwise, I think, I have been looking at the emails you've been sending me, and I'm not completely up to date on responding to everybody. And I think at a certain point, so don't be dismayed if you haven't heard from me very recently, like since, I don't know, this weekend or something like that. It's been a little more hectic than I would have liked. Anyway, I will get to them all, I should think, tomorrow. Now, let's see. In that connection, I think we have something coming up. Let's see, course information, and that'll help us. Probably we have, let's see, spring break, topics due. Okay, we're in 10th week. In theory, we need the, you'll be giving me a progress report next week. And the progress report is, again, by email. You could say Baroque paper progress report as the subject of your email. And in that, you tell me everything that has happened since the last time we communicated. That's to say, how much further you've gotten, what you've looked at, what ideas you've had, how you're narrowing things down, if in fact you are. Now, it is not a tragedy yet, it might be a comedy, if not much has happened, but the point of this is to keep you thinking about the fact that I'm thinking about it, I suppose, something on that order. Now, if it's, some of you I've been in touch with quite recently, and so it might seem ridiculous to have a progress report after, like I've just answered something from you. Maybe we should say progress report should be the following week, which I think that would be the 12th week right here. The 12th week, but that would mean that it's only two, yeah, according to this, only two more until when the paper is due. What do you say about that? I suppose you could do it either way. Send it to me this week or next week, as seems best to you, but one or the other. I don't care which day. So let's say by Friday of next week, send me something, and then we'll go from there. And otherwise, I know of no other practical business to talk about at this time. Do you have any business to bring up, old or new? Okay.
Dr. Maddox.
Yeah.
Have you determined, you had commented at the beginning of the semester that we were possibly going to do like we did last semester with the final online?
It is my wish and my intention to do that. I'm not as handy with those things as Professor Dupree, he's worked with. My impression is that Blackboard is not so user-friendly in that regard in doing certain kinds of questions. On the other hand, the sort of thing I'd be asking would be pretty straightforward, I think. So I think you can assume that there'll be some kind of online test. We do have to have a test. I sometimes, get to the end of the semester and say, oh, do we really need to have a test? Your paper will be fine. Well, but in this case, since there isn't a whole lot of interaction during, or not necessarily during, during, and certainly not always with me, during the lectures. And since we, this is the, I mean, there's a paper and then there's this other thing, that's all there is. So it's hard not to, you know, want to do that. I think I may have said, and in any case I will say now, because it is true, I do tend for to like things to be text-based. And so what I have done in the past, and may do on this occasion, is at some point I will give you possibly passages. Now they would be, you'd use them as basis for commenting more largely on texts and figures and movements and whatnot. For aiming at a somewhat global appreciation of the period, at least the aspects of what we've talked about. Of course, you could think of it in terms of sort of grouping things together, like things with like things, and asking a general question about that involves all of them. And that would be a nice thing. And I might do that. However, this uncertainty of mine, I think, is okay. I think it's maybe better that you not know everything that I could tell you if I could tell you now. I would say it is going to be text-based, and it is always good to go back over texts and look at them and think about them and kind of get as much of them into your head as you can or as you think is useful. So the structure of them, the purpose of them, the impact of possibly things like when they were written. I do not mind factology, a certain amount of factology. And that means, like, you know, bunches of facts. Even if I ask you to do a comment on a passage, I like you to be able to say, well, this passage occurs in this particular text, at this point in the text, written at a particular date by this particular person, and that sort of thing, and whatever else you think is appropriate to throw in there. So that sort of contextual knowledge, if you want to call it that, historical surroundings of texts is important. So that's what I would say at this time. So it's always good to review. I think of when I would prepare for a test in which texts were important, I would go over the whole text, maybe not reread the whole thing in detail, but I would certainly look at the important passages or what seemed to be such, maybe make notes on them, and try to get a sense of the whole rather than just a series of events. But, well, you need to know what the series is. If it's a play, you need to know what the action of the play is. You need to know who the main characters are. You need to know what's at stake in the play, and so forth. And similarly, mutatis mutandis for other kinds of texts. Anyway, those are my words of recommendation. Right. I think it's probably a good thing that we do try for, whether or not it's spoken about at a particular moment in the text, in the chorus with regard to a particular text or subject or not, it is good to be thinking about what might be dominant issues of, if not the chorus as a whole, at least a certain part of the chorus. Or if there is something that, if you're coming to some kind of a provisional understanding of what the Baroque is or what it might be, what it might include, well, this is a good thing to be thinking about as you're looking at these various texts. Like, I'm not sure what I would say. Well, I'd have some things to say, I think. All right. Now, we are getting on tonight to our, what I think of as the next stage. And this is appropriate. Now, Calderon is, well, his dates are not so far off from what we're doing now, but I suppose our Molière is more in keeping with, let's see, the Poussin lecture that we'll be having shortly, since he is the great representative driving force in classicism in art, particularly in the French context, but it's very influential on the rest of Europe. And that's what we're looking at tonight, as one of the leading figures in French classicism. Now, when we say French classicism, that does not mean neoclassicism. Indeed, some people may call it that, but wrongly. They are indeed making a big deal of the ancients. They are trying very consciously to imitate the ancients in certain regards. They are not the first to have done this. Nevertheless, the French nowadays, since that time, think of this as one of the great periods of classicism. Like there were maybe two big ones that we know about in our part of the world, namely Greek and Roman, certain parts of Greek and Roman, certain parts of history of Greek, so 4th, 3rd century, say, and then for a century or so around the change into the new era, that's a high point of classicism, or two high points of classicism. But the other one is France in the latter part of the 17th century. And by golly, that's not neo anything. That's just straight classicism. And you don't talk about French classicism. It's just le classicisme. When they say le classicisme in French people speaking, they mean, if without any other qualification, it'll mean 17th century French literature of the of the 60s, 70s, and a little bit of the 80s. Okay, and you move on to other things after that, but it is a pivotal period. It is one that has a lasting impact, and certainly up until the present day in French. All right, now I have up here, and we will get to this, let's see, as a means of helping us. I think I'm going to make this disappear for right now. And, oh, let's see, did I put up here somewhere? Somewhere. Yes. Okay, very good. I think we'll get this to open. I think I'm getting it now. Oh, there we are. All right, this is currently up, let's see. This is up on your, on Blackboard now, in various forms, in document form and in PDF form. The document form, they're all in very, very big letters. That's so you can see them now. But there's a OD, what do they call that? Open document thing. It's one of those is open document file, and the other is RTF. So if you want to look at these or use them for yourselves, you can take them and reduce the size so that if you wanted to print it out, it wouldn't be, 50 pages like it is right now. All right, let me get some notes of my own that I have somewhere here. That would be very good. La, 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 la. That seems to be working. All righty. Okay, well, I suppose, we have talked about some of the, all along, aspects of the Baroque period, such as we've defined it here. As we move into the what might be called the classical period, and I think I talk a little bit later on in this. Let's see if this will. Oh, we don't need this. Do you know how I can get rid of that? Which is, it's invisible anyway. You can't see anything there. Oh, well. Somewhere I've got. Oh, yes. Yes. At least in terms of... France, roughly, this might correspond to some other things, or maybe there would be a little bit of a delay, but you could still say the same. The heyday of the Baroque would be perhaps up until 1630. Although there are certain aspects of Baroque that certainly continue after that. Pre-classical, 1630 to 1660, there are leftovers of the Baroque. People still like very much Baroque-style theater. Nevertheless, there are people who are thinking about how we could make, I don't know, more rational or more regular the various genres that we're writing in literature, in the arts as well. People are thinking about this and the fine arts in terms possibly of government and so forth. These are all issues that are bubbling around in people's minds. And then finally, we have this period here where a lot of the thinking has already been done, the formulation of ideals of various sorts, but now you have, in a certain sense, you have the realization of it, or people who are trying to do great and new works using classical precepts. Now, in a sense, I believe I've said, certainly the Baroque and the classical can be thought of as one period, since the classical is, in a sense, an attempt to answer certain of the questions brought up by the Baroque period. Questions, for instance, of certainty, questions of order, questions of what you do with the with the the mixed up character of life, the fact that life presents itself at least some of the time as a very confusing thing, as a dark place, as a place of illusion, where you can't really tell what you're doing, what the reality of things is. It's a place also of where we, certainly classical elements are present and are being used, but sometimes in a very dramatic, not very classical way, in a kind of an expressive way almost, in which tension and not harmony is what is most prominent, in which a certain kind of emotion is present or very close under the surface. So there's a kind of a dynamism, but also maybe a dangerousness, peril present in that energy and in that kind of disturbance or roiling about that in a way seems characteristic of the first or hardcore Baroque. So I think that the classical folks later on, the theoreticians and the practitioners in the later parts of the century, are in a certain sense accept that as a starting point, as a kind of a reality, but they are trying to deal with it in the most rational, human, humane way that they can. And that, so in a certain sense, it is this is the answer to that, the questions posed by the Baroque and answer posed by them. An answer that tries to use human reason to deal with rather murky aspects of life, of human life, without denying the fact that there is that murkiness. The murkiness is there. But trying to deal with that in the most sensible way possible. So in a way, they're the two halves of the same thing, two sides of a coin, if you like. This classical synthesis, as far as France is concerned, is not going to last very long in a certain sense. And in fact, the period immediately after it, the last 10 or 15 years of the century, and the first few years of the next century, have been described as a sort of a liminal period, a pivotal period, where we're moving into quite a different mindset from what had been characteristic of the 17th century. But perhaps that destabilization that you have in the final period is also something that is inherent in some of the dynamisms present from the very beginning. Any rate, something to think about. Now, all right. So we have a search for order and for search for certainty of a psychological, of a religious sort. We have in politics, a move towards absolutism, and as a kind of a solution for, certainly in France, for the civil discord that you'd had previously, and for the tension that still existed between a central authority and the local nobility, and particularly the high nobles. Okay, and here I talk about, contrasting the Baroque, the earlier part of the century, and then what is later going to be the classical apogee. Divergent, this is all in French, but it'll be easy enough, I think, to make out what is being said here. Divergent tendencies and then convergent tendencies. Yes, there's a lot of disagreement about certain things, about what the right kind of poetry is, what the right kind of theater is, and here people are tending to agree more, you might say, and maybe in other respects as well. The Baroque, at least that part of it, could be thought of as a period of preparation for what is going to be realized more emphatically in the later period. So what do we have here? Politics. You certainly have movement towards centralizing policy of the prime ministers, Richelieu, the first of these, and then Mazarin, who's his successor. Both of them cardinals, that didn't seem to make a whole lot of difference. Mazarin was Italian, Richelieu was French-born nobility, not particularly high nobility, but he became the great power in the land, working on behalf, of course, of Louis XIII. Nevertheless, he was the one who, among other things, was going to be bringing to a more obedient position the loyalty, the nobility. Any rate, okay. So these people, and then classical period, you have absolutism at its most at its greatest point, which is not absolute absolutism, but is certainly as far as it ever got, you could say. In letters, okay, so in literature, we already have people who are working out the principles of the classical ideal in literature, poetry, the different genres, theater, diction of all kinds. Okay, so formation of a classicizing consensus, 1630 to 1630. I've got 34, I thought it was 35. Well, at any rate, these things are a little bit vague sometimes, or depends on what you define as a foundation. Foundation of the Académie Française, the first of the French academies, in 1634, which was especially supposed to take care of literary and linguistic matters. That was its particular field. That included not only language, although one of their projects was theoretically to come up with a dictionary. Also a grammar. I think they did the dictionary, but not the grammar. But they also, at least in the 17th century, would comment on literary critical issues of the day and try to settle quarrels of a literary sort. At any rate, okay, then we have, as I say, the great realization with great classical authors later on in the century. I have here, now I couldn't make these too big, the letters, the characters too big, because, well, you know, they would destroy everything. But this gives you some kind of factology, chronology. And more or less you have correspondence of this column, this column, and this column. This column is just the reigns, and Louis XIII, which goes from 1610 to 1643 when he dies, and then the reign of Louis XIV, starting in 1643, but he does not have his majority, neither does what's-his-face, does Louis XIII when he becomes king. And Louis XIV's reign goes on and on and on and on to 1715. Over in the second column, you see a little bit, it's broken down a little bit more. One thing, when the king in question begins his personal reign, 1614, as it says here, theoretical or is legal end of his minority and of the regents of his mother, Marie de Médicis, and then his real end with the assassination of a person who there was an important minister at that time, and an Italian, in 1617. Well, I guess you do what you have to do. And from that time on, he is a king in his own right. However, about 5 years after that, he chooses this fellow Richelieu, who was probably a churchman. I should think he was a churchman already. But he is, it says here, named principal ministre. That may be a term they used. It was not yet a technical term or an easily recognized term recognized by anybody. In fact, this guy seems to have been the first prime minister ever. Later on, they would call it premier ministre. So a king would have, it would be normal, and certainly this is the practice of Louis XIV later on, a king would have ministers under him who would have, you know, special aspects of government that they would be particularly dealing with and report to the king and implement his policies. Indeed, this is the basis for our, what do we call it? Cabinet is what we call it. And in England, it's called the government and so forth. But with the prime minister at the head of that, our president, of course, is also a prime minister, whereas in other systems, you have the two functions separated. And that's based on the separation between the king on the one hand and this principal minister. Why was he a principal minister? He took over everything, all aspects of government. And the king still did something, maybe perhaps having particularly to do with warfare or the aspects that he was interested in. Louis XIII was interested in, I'm sure he was interested in hunting. He was interested in dancing. Now, this is a question we'll come back to, but dancing was a big part of the court life. And it was much more elaborate than even the kinds of things you might think of, with sort of elegant steps and a somewhat complicated set of steps that you do to a court music. There's more to it than that, actually. They would put on what we would call ballets that would be represented an entire action. and for which you'd put on special costumes and you'd learn special steps and so on and so forth. Whatever Richelieu did was certainly done in consultation with the king. But otherwise, he was in charge of everything. Now, he also had these particular aims, if you could say, to decrease the power of the nobility. So to bring them down as much as possible. Destroy the Protestants as a political party. Now, these two things are not completely separate because the Protestants in question would have been particularly certain nobility who had adhered to the new religion or the new form of Christianity, or the old form, if you want to call it that. And so these are two sides of the same thing, if you like. That is, to assure political hegemony within France and the superiority, the supremacy of the king as a political power there. Now, the other thing was directed towards outside policy, policy of state, foreign policy, we would call it, and that is to diminish the importance, do whatever you could to reduce the importance, the power of the Habsburgs, the Habsburg Empire, which had been a more than a thorn in the side of France since the preceding century, at least, out throughout the 16th century. But now that the French kings have gotten their act together, have gotten their country together, more or less gotten it together, now they can concentrate more, as in fact Francis I had done. He was a great enemy of the Habsburgs and they of him. They can get back to that as well. So if France is to be important in Europe, you've got to diminish the importance of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, all right, then various other things. Now, Richelieu, as we will see, or as it'll come up again undoubtedly, he was, also took a great interest in cultural matters, and particularly matters of letters, fine letters, belles lettres. And so there's the beginning of what will certainly increase and reach its apogee under Louis the 14th, and that is a kind of a centralization of the arts, of all kinds of cultural products. All righty, then we have death of Richelieu, and shortly after that, the death of Louis XIII, and we have another regency, Anne of Autriche, wife of Louis XIII, of course, and then soon after this, around this time, Mazarin becomes the next Premier Ministre. Now, it's an interesting time and a difficult time. Both of the regencies, the one with Louis XIII and this one with Louis the 14th, are difficult times. And there is a sort of, this reaches its climax right around 1450, a little before, a little after, in this thing I think I'm talking about called La Fronde, which is a sort of a half, I don't want to say half-hearted, and it's vulgar to say half-assed, but at any rate, not a very effective, not a very well-organized, well-planned revolt against not royal power, but against, theoretically, the power of the prime minister. Any rate, I believe I've talked about this before, that La Fronde was had a profound psychological impact on Louis the 14th, and he was certainly determined to realize the dream, the ideal of Richelieu and Louis the 13th of a supremely powerful monarch that no one would question, whose authority no one would question. Okay, La Fronde, okay, there. Yes, the treasure is in a bad state and so forth. If you like, the 50s are sort of a renewal, or they're, in a way, they're a very Baroque period if you associate the Baroque with a feeling of uncertainty, even of desperation, of confusion, of uncertainty about how things are going to turn out. As I say there's a political uncertainty, there's also religious uncertainty, because this is the high point of the Jansenist crisis, or one of the high points at least. Louis the 14th himself would associate Jansenism, or think of Jansenism as a rebellious activity on the part of, among others, nobility that wouldn't settle down and do behave like he wanted them to. So the Arnauds, for instance, the Grand Arnaud, Antoine Arnauld, and his his niece, the abbess of Port-Royal, they were members of a noble family, and so he would think of that as a this another manifestation of a Fronde-like attitude, not accepting the supreme authority of the king. Okay, now, although he had technically reached his minority already, Mazarin, Louis XIV, didn't sort of take over the reins from him until Mazarin actually died. And this was a point. This is a moment where he could, show what he was worth or what he could do. And to everyone's amazement, he said at this time, "I'm not going to have any premier ministre. I will be my own, not grandpa, but I will be my own premier ministre." And essentially, that's what he did. That is to say, he had his council of ministers of various sorts for various aspects of the government. But they had to come not to a first minister for permission to do things, but to himself, to him, not to anybody else. And he did take a very active interest in everything that was being done. Now, it is true that he did have a particular minister, and I think this is Intendant de Finance or something like that, financial guy, theoretically, this is Colbert. And Colbert was something almost approaching a first minister. He was he had his hands in all kinds of different activities, all kinds of parts of government. Government means not only collecting taxes and providing laws and making sure that criminals get punished and so forth, but it doesn't simply mean fighting wars. In their understanding, it also meant promotion of France in every possible domain. Now, all of this was to redound to the glory of the king. Nevertheless, it redounded to the glory of the king that France should be wealthy, that it should be successful in commerce, for instance, that it should be successful in industry such as it was understood back at that time. Here we have the beginnings of, and it's going to continue into the next century, of this new role that France will have, more than it had previously, of being the provider of fine objects, of wonderful ceramics, pottery, of the finest tapestries, of whatever other things you might think of, but as a, of silverwork and of gold. Craftsmanship, great works, artistic works, but for various uses. This is a time when France really comes to the fore, and it is because of the policy of these people. Right. Now, of course, they also wanted to make a lot of money, and so they could have wars of all kinds. All right. Down here, I give you. Let's see. When the two kings were born, when the regency ended. Wait. Oh, yes, regency began because their fathers died, and then the personal reign when that begins, and then finally their death at the very end of that. Okay. Now, a few names we talked about here. Okay, the classical and even the high pre-classical period is not until 1630, but even so, even before that, you have some people who are moving towards a classical ideal. I should perhaps mention that there is, well, this would affect poetry and prose, both poetry and prose. And this is sort of the French version of Baroque, a Baroque ideal of diction in both poetry and prose. That's preciosity. Preciosity doesn't mean quite what we mean in English, except we never say preciosity. It doesn't mean what it means in English to say precious, unless you mean it in a French sense. It was a movement that was sort of intellectual and sort of literary and decidedly feminine. It was partly because increasingly nobility were discouraged from talking about politics of any kind. Noble men did have the function, they had to be officers in the army. Their basic function was to fight. And in various cases to be ministers, but not all the time, for say Louis XIV. But the Yes, but politics was increasingly understood as the domain of the king only. Even there, his advisors could advise one thing or another, but had no say, ultimately, in what was done. It was not a democratic arrangement at all. Now, so what to do? What to spend your time with if you're waiting around for wars in between when they're not wars, or if you are a woman? You can't involve yourself in intrigues, or you'd better not. And so one of the things they turned to was intellectual interests, primarily, for instance, in arts, and primarily things having to do with literature. And so we have the phenomena of the salon, the gatherings that would take place at the homes of, to begin with nobility or members of the high bourgeoisie. And they would bring together meeting on a more or less regular basis. It could be on a daily basis or weekly or whatever it might be, to discuss things of common, of mutual interest. And these would tend to be things like, well, certain literary forms, certain kinds of poems, and, oh yes, love. a certain ideal of love that was promulgated by the same group of people. This was a society that was mainly, how should I say, that was led by women in a certain sense. That is to say, it was they who set the tone and set the standards as well. And associated with preciosity is a certain attitude towards love life and a certain attitude towards language, I guess, and the language arts in a certain sense. They're very interested in the affective life, the emotional life, and its, how should I say, its ins and outs, its various stages. And so they would be interested, for instance, in finding terms to distinguish the various degrees of going from inclination to somebody, a light for somebody, to friendship, to attachment, to passion, and so on and so forth. Well, they didn't like getting to passion, actually. They liked analysis had to do this way. They liked elegant language that would be used to express these things and to express courteous sentiments, affectionate sentiments to women. And, as I say, there's an interest in how to express these things. So this definitely has a literary critical side. There's a sort of a human side to it, interest in a certain aspect in human relations and so forth, and a certain ideal of these relations as well. Some people have called this an early feminist movement. But there's also the issue, the side of language. And associated with preciosity is what would later be thought of as an excess in a super refinement of language. There were certain crude terms that were to be excluded. You would not speak about them. Common items were to be referred to by a paraphrase of some kind. That's a peri, P-E-R-I, phrase, not by their normal terms. They very much appreciated wit, what in French is called esprit. And so showing your wit in the way that you formulate these elegant minor poetic forms, and express at the same time a very courtly manner towards women, courtly attitude towards women. Now, this is sort of the French version, or a French version, of a Baroque literary ideal, or a Baroque stylistic ideal, a Baroque kind of language that you use for literary works. And what is in keeping with, they would sometimes go in for, sometimes the wit that you would show would be a little bit involved, would take a little bit of while to figure out, and so it would be difficult. Later on, this is going to be something that will be utterly rejected. Difficulty, no. Nonetheless, there are certain aspects of this literary and affective ideal that do get subsumed into classicism. Okay, so at any rate, but you have people like early, Malherbe is the great name of the person who reformed French prosody. Prosody meaning the rules of versification. And although you had had, in the previous century, you had had a humanist movement in literature, and people who just said, we're going to reform the way literature is done. We're going to do poetry right. and we're going to dress up the French language like it's never been done before. Well, sadly, by these people, on into the 17th century, they said, oh, well, you got it wrong. Your heart was maybe in the right place, but you had the wrong way of going about it. And so after the 16th century writers had more or less dumped the medieval tradition, then the 17th century proceeded to do the same thing to what the 16th century writers had done. And this comes to be, I think, an important aspect of the French literary tradition, which is to say, no tradition. That is to say, you wipe out what comes before, and you start anew, and say, this time we're going to do it right, by golly. Now, Malherbe is the first, and then he's very, very important for rules of prosody. And among other things, this idea that, by golly, you don't write something that isn't clear. If a reader reading your poetry has to pause and wonder about what you mean, this is wrong. This is wrong. Okay, well, we go on. The guy who's doing something similar for prose in general is this fellow, not Honoré de Balzac, but an earlier Balzac. Okay. And then some other aspects of things that are happening, we're getting a bit later on into the in the century, but Richelieu, I talked to you about how he was interested in cultural matters, and in particular, things regarding literature. And he was involved in the foundation of the Académie Française in 1635. And here's some other academies that came up. So I guess the Académie Française is the very first of the French academies, as far as I know. And you know that the academies, it goes back to the idea of what they're doing in Florence, the academy they had there, which is a gathering of intellectuals, some of whom were literary people, but not all of them, philosophers, in 15th century, and I suppose 16th to a certain extent. But that itself was theoretically an imitation or re-beginning of the Academy of Plato, although it had very little in common with what that academy must have been. Okay. Anyway, some other academies that they eventually came up with. Académie Royale de Peinture et de Sculpture. This says it's 1448, so that's already in the period of of the minority of Louis XIV. So Académie de Musique, Académie Royale d'Architecture. These are all in their various ways are very important for kind of setting standards for saying what is going to be helping people to understand both the makers of these objects and the people who use them or appreciated them, what is the right way to do this particular kind of building, this particular kind of painting, and so forth. Very much based on certain understanding of the classical practice and of things that had happened in these three here that you see at the top of this page here are eventually, I think in the 19th century, they're combined into the one Académie des Beaux-Arts, I think, of fine arts. Now, just for a little comparison here, the Royal Society, which is a sort of a omnium gatherum of intellectuals in England, was started in 1660, which is, well, considerably after these others, although it could be considered the earliest of the scientific academies, although they didn't only do what we would think of as hard science, but that was one of the main things. And you see, a French one comes not too terribly long after that. All right, so that was a quite one. Oh, who's another fellow here? Oh, L'Abbé d'Aubignac. He kind of goes up into our period, but he's... And he's important already in the 30s. He's important, 30s, 40s, 50s. And among other things, abbé means he was a priest. He was a secular priest. That is to say, he wasn't a member of a religious order. He was just an ordinary priest. and they called him abbé because that's what they called him back then. Abbé being the same thing as abbot. It's just father. It's another way of saying father. In at least before 1968, when everything changed, you would say to a priest who is a member of a religious order, you would say, Père, mon père, my father. Père, father. But to a person who's just a secular priest, you'd say, Abbé, Monsieur l'Abbé. They probably don't make that distinction anymore. At any rate, many of these abbés already in the 17th century, and even more in the 18th century, their activity seems to have nothing at all to do with religious concerns, religious matters. So what he was interested in was belles lettres, was fine letters, was artistic literature. And that's what he worked on. And one of the things, he worked on a number of different subjects, but one of the things was interpretation of the classical rules of tragedy and possibly comedy too. This, of course, was based particularly on Aristotle, on his Poetics, which had been discovered, I forget, I don't have that information in my head right now, but, or at any rate, not accessible. 16th century, there are a lot of people commenting on it, particularly in Italy. And 17th century, if not before, the French really get into it too. And they're fascinated with it, and they're all, many of them are convinced that this is the way to go. We've got to figure out what it is, how they're doing things. They had this great, and here we're thinking of not so much the Roman models, which Shakespeare had available, but they were rather corrupt, rather decadent. But no, it's the Greek of the great classical period. So this is gets to be a particularly heated issue in the pre-classical period. And here I want to mention this guy, who unfortunately we're not reading, Pierre de Corneille, the first great name as a dramaturge, as a dramatic writer, writer for the theater. He stretches over a good part of the century. And some people would say that he's inherently more of a Baroque dramatist than a classical one. He certainly has some plays that are very Baroque in their flavor. Some people would say that he remains not classical, and I agree with this in a certain understanding, not classical in his conception of the hero. And when I say classical, I mean not French classical. It is not like what, say, the classical idea of the tragic hero will be. Now, over the years in his long career, he did move towards or did adopt the practice of following the rules of classical tragedy in particular. A turning point was this. His first really big success was, which was El Cid. So what? 12th, 13th century Spanish hero, subject of an epic, but who was? I think he's 12th century, but the epic is 13th century. He wasn't using that text as his source, but there were plays that had been written about him in Spanish, for instance, and he decides to tell the story. And this is a sort of an in-between thing, a thing that is going to be called, in this text, the context, tragicomedy. Or, I should say more specifically, tragicomedy is a Baroque genre. Whereas tragédie classique, that follows the rules. Tragicomédie is something that is thought of as not following, oh, it's just all crazy, it's all wacky. And it basically, tragicomédie is the sort of thing that you see in Shakespeare, all over, just about in all of his plays. Yes, sir?
Kind of like Euripides?
No, no. Well, okay, he may not be, you know, the high point of classicism, according to some definitions. No. But he would be, I mean, he's still going to have a limitation on the number of characters he can have and on the things that can happen on the stage. And I think he would be embraced in what these guys would think of as
comedy.
There is that. The comedy, yes, I suppose some aspects of ancient comedy would be, but the old comedy is more Baroque-like. It's more of a, yes, Baroque style. That is to say, there aren't these hard and fast rules that you have in particular. But, or at any rate, they don't seem as such to us. But in the Baroque setting, at least for France, and I happily extend this to others, tragicomedy is this mixed bag of thing where you can have actions can be improbable. You can have witches and fairies in it, if you like. Other supernatural beings and occurrences. You have you can't tell what's coming next. You can't have a prediction of, you know, this is a single action that's going to happen. This has, you know, maybe there's one or two, very few possibilities how this is going to end up. Rather, it could go in any direction. You could have something that seems like it's heading towards disaster, and suddenly, victory is seized from the jaws of, you know, defeat. Also, there can be lots and lots of characters. The point is, the ideal here, the defenders of this kind of theater would say, the ideal is pleasure, entertainment. This is what the public wants. Or as the classicists would say, we don't care what the public wants. We need to teach them what they ought to want. Or they might say, this is what they really, really want if they had their heads on straight. At any rate, the Cid was, even he admitted, was a tragicomedy. At first, that's what he said when he first published it. It is a sort of a hybrid genre, a tragicomédie régulière, a regular tragicomedy. That is to say, a tragicomedy that to a certain extent follows the rules. Now, what are the rules? They're very simple. And I don't have them down here anywhere, which is unfortunate, but I'll tell them to you. Take these down. Okay. There are, first of all, the three unities. What are the three unities? Place, time, and action. Place, well, not just one town, but the stage represents one place and one place only. Time, something like a day. Something like a day. You can have a night in there, and it can be a little bit more than 24 hours, I think. Aristotle says something like this. Okay, but no more than that. Now you're compressing it as it is. Presumably, though, in each scene, no, not in each scene, in each act, as they practice it, that's real time you've got. In between the acts, you might have some time in between that. But this is already, this is the poor imaginative brain of the spectators can't go any farther than that. They can manage one day and pretend that it's happening in a couple of hours, but they can't do more than that. So, okay, so Tagman says action, meaning it's got to have unitary action, not too many characters, you know, one, maybe two heroes, you know, but not two different stories going on. You don't have subordinate stories that distract you from the main one. And it's also unity of action in the Aristotelian sense, that there's a clear curve to the action, a clear direction to the action, with a, as he says, but his words mean more than they seem, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Beginning, middle, and an end in an organic sense, or one thing building out of another and going logically towards the crisis and the resolution. Okay, and you sort of see that. You have a sense of that from the beginning. It's getting tenser and tenser and tenser until there's finally the crisis. Okay, so those are the three unities. Then what else is there? Okay, there is probability, also an Aristotelian concept. That is to say, it has to be the sort of thing that you could imagine happening. Therefore, not horribly unusual things that happen only once in the world, not things that are not generally part of the belief system of the audience, and whatever else. Okay, so probability. Then there was, I would say, unity of style, or the rules of style. For different genres, different styles were appropriate. And you didn't mix them. You didn't mix them. Just like you wouldn't mix a comic plot and a serious plot. you would have, let's see. Well, but this is more specifically talking about diction, the way people speak, the way you have them speak. High style for tragedy, in which you have noble characters. Low style for comedy, in which you have middle class and servant class, and very distinct, very strong distinction in the way you have people talk in those different kinds. Middle style doesn't necessarily come into plays; it's more for philosophy. It's just sort of straightforward, inoffensive, unremarkable, and so forth. Anyway, Le Cid of Gonnet was kind of fit a loose interpretation of the unities, but not completely. It takes place in one city, but in different places in the city. It takes place in, I don't know, maybe over a couple of weeks or a week or something like that, which is a bit too long. It has more than one action in it, or some of the people said it had more than one. It had a subordinate action going along with the main one. Then, let's see, probability. It's also ridiculous, and it doesn't care. It doesn't matter if it happened once. He's saying it's historical. Corneille would defend himself saying that. If it happened, then it's probable. This is not Aristotle. And many people got him on this. The improbability is this woman agreeing to marry, eventually, the fellow who murdered or killed her father. Now, there is also an offense here. The same aspect of the play was an offense against what they called, this is the last thing, maybe the sixth item we're talking about now, bienséance. Bienséance, B-I-E-N-S-E, with an acute accent, A-N-C-E-S, for plural. Bienséance. And this is proprieties. Here is perhaps something of the influence of the of the preciosity, of the précieuse and the précieux, that you don't talk about certain things, you don't show certain things. Well, there's an actual act of violence that occurs. One nobleman slaps another on the stage in plain view of everybody. Well, and there are some other things they thought were offenses. Also, the idea of the very subject, the idea of this woman marrying the man who had killed her father. This is an offense against the SAOs. Anyway, so this is a big quarrel. It went on into 1637, the following year, and it got to be such a big deal that Richelieu asked the Académie Française, which had been recently founded, to look into it and see if they could put it into the matter, sort of. And so they draw up their judgment on La Querelle du Cid and their opinion about here, you know, the critics of this play are wrong, but in these other places, yes, they have a point that you shouldn't have done this, and so on and so forth. So as a result of which, Corneille didn't write anything for 3 years. And from then on, the next play that he wrote was completely within the classical rules, at least perhaps not with regard to content, but certainly with regard to the rules as most people would have interpreted them at that time. Okay, but what about Molière? So we have, by this time we're getting to have, and it happens only really in the 17th century because there wasn't opportunities for it before, a very vibrant theatrical production in the 17th century, associated particularly with the 17th century. In particular, there were certainly groups that went around and put on plays, but it is somewhat later that you actually have, and I actually don't know the exact date, when you have permanent playhouses. They would normally be the place where a particular troupe hung out and put on its performances. And an author would go to this particular troupe, this particular playhouse, and say, here, I have this play, I'd like you to put it on, and that's how it would work. Now, presumably we do have, so some people are getting these notions at a certain point about the more classical style of plays, but there are many plays which are in the tragicomic or in the Baroque mold. Also, very strong influence throughout the century are Italian models and Spanish models. Not German models and not English models, for whatever reason, I don't know. Certainly in part because it's easier maybe to understand things written in other Romance languages, not quite so foreign, and many of these models would be in the Baroque mold, very definitely, not in the classical. Molière, we see him, born in 1622. His father, it says his father, again, this is in French, sorry, but you know, I'll help you out. He worked with cloth, with things that would use for, not just for tapestries, but for any kind of cloth, I think, it would use in apartments, in rooms. But that was actually a very important thing because they used a lot of these in the 17th century. And in fact, he was a royal tapissier. He was a tapissier for the king. So he was certainly a well-to-do member of the bourgeoisie. And you see that he was able to afford study for his son at the Collège de Clermont, which I think we've talked about some, have we not? In connection with the Jesuits. This is their big place in Paris. Okay. Now, his father intended, as many fathers have done then at that time and since, wanted his son to go into law. Because that was certainly, for someone who is in member of the bourgeoisie, this is a very, very clear road upward. And it was much more likely that you could get a position or could become ennobled if you knew the law. And apparently he was in Orléans for some, a certain point, but he, at a certain point, very young, he decides, no, that's not the way I'm going to go. I'm going to go into the theater. Now, this was a big decision. He must have seen, he must have already in his young days in Paris, he must have seen a lot of theater, whatever was available at that time. And we're going, let's see, 22, so we're going up to 20s. He's getting on to, well, around 40, 60, 40. So he would have known some of those early successes of Corneille, for instance. He's mad for the theater. And mad, really mad, that is, this, doing this is a crazy thing. It's, you're gonna, you just didn't do that. He ends up being, actually, he is the playwright and the organizer and the actor, the director, and the manager, so-called, and an actor in his troupe, what is going to be his troupe. In other words, like Shakespeare. But what was permitted for a Shakespeare was, in France at this time, was, now it's one thing to write plays. That was okay. And there's a little bit of a, you know, inconsistency here, I must agree. It's one thing to write plays, what such as Pierre Corneille did, but he never acted in them. Now he might consult with the people putting it on and so forth and oversee the production to a certain extent. But he was not himself an actor. Actors were, well, they were kind of like, well, they were scum. They were not reputable people, or at least many people thought of them that way. Yes, ma'am? Yes, very true. They were going to—he was already a persona non grata in the ecclesiastical establishment, very definitely. And they were not going to give him a church burial.
Why would they not give actors church burial?
Well, that was a general principle. They are, by the nature of their profession, they live an unchristian life. There's sort of a part of this. This is not unconnected with the issues that we talked about. Speaking about Pascal, that is to say, that what is compatible with the Christian life, what walks of life, what activities are compatible with that, and many people would say that acting is not, at least in the current state of affairs, in the ways that actors acted, lived, or people thought that they lived. In any case, it was not a reputable walk of life. It was assumed that, well, you move around a lot, and then of course you're sort of mixed in promiscuously, male and female, without anybody watching over it. And what else would be a problem there? Well, then you do all these kinds of stories where, you know, love and passion comes in, and all kinds of excess, people out of their minds, and representing immoral actions on the stage. So. But that was part of it, the content of the plays, but also the fact just this kind of style of life was not an ordered life. And it's difficult to see how you could avoid immorality.
If it was the content of the plays that was the problem, then why would the playwrights attend?
Well, sometimes, it might depend on the play. There are also degrees of strictness. Now, there would be ecclesiastics who would say, don't go to plays at all. You shouldn't go to plays at all. And others who would be more easygoing and say, you can go to plays, but you can't be an actor. And as I say, there's some inconsistency here. You might have a bishop who's saying he's fulminating against people who go to plays, having anything to do with plays. Other ecclesiastics, these abbés, for instance, this the Daubignac fellow, he wrote plays, as well as wrote about plays. So he had no objection to, in some sense, this. And if you can write plays, you want them to be put on, so you want somebody to be able to do it. Nonetheless, it still was not accepted as in certain important sectors of society, and authoritative ones in certain cases, as an up and up thing to do. Now, it might also be a particular ruling of a particular bishop at a particular time and place that we're not going to allow Christian burial of actors. And it might be because of particular circumstances or recent disputes or conflicts that they've had. Also, there's the fact that in the case of Molière, he was notorious as a person who had attacked certain religious attitudes and had set himself up as a moral teacher in a way that churchly authority would not allow. So he was outstanding as a bugbear, what do we call these things, for Ecclesiastes.
Wasn't he like within this close to being
excommunicated?
Saved by Louis XIV.
He excommunicated, burned at the stake. There were certainly some who called for his being burned, of his enemies, people who wrote pamphlets against him. Something bad. And indeed, Louis did protect him, could not protect him beyond a certain point. But he did keep him out of ecclesiastical jail, at least. So what were we saying? So the idea of doing this is extremely bohemian. This is extremely, what was the term? You know, like 60s. This is rebellion. This is teenage rebellion. This is countercultural in the extreme. Although not in his own understanding necessarily. Okay, now, let's see here. He's in Paris. Maybe he's, I don't know what's going on here. Well, he's just about 20 at this point. He is in Paris. And he joins up with this thing that is going to be called the Illustre Théâtre, which he will eventually become head of, in 1643. They try to make a go of it in Paris, but they fail terribly, and so they decide to go to be a traveling troupe. And you notice, well, that's what they did for a long time. And in a sense, these are years when we know not very much about it. And we don't have productions from that time or plays from him during that time. He may have done things, you know, that were got from other people or written by other people. He might have done little sketches, because amongst the influences you have, certainly Commedia dell'arte is a present influence here, where you have sort of sketchy kind of plays, of plots. You have certain set characters played by always the same people and so forth. You set up a situation and then you just tell them go, and you know what you're supposed to do, and you don't have to write out the dialogue for them all the way. Now, and there may be certain things he was getting onto that he published later, but we don't know. It had various names. It would be protected by various people at certain points. Here, rather close to the period we're getting to, he gets the patronage of Monsieur. Monsieur was the title given to the brother of the king, his younger brother. Now, Monsieur was kind of notorious for other reasons, but I'm not going to go into that. You can see the feature films about that. I don't think you can get it in region 1 on DVD, but on region 2 if you have a multi-region player. There's a musical, and I'm not recommending this, there's a musical called Le Roi Soleil, which is to say the Sun King. And by golly, it's about Louis XIV and the madcap adventures that he and the other people at the court of that time have. It's all pretty ridiculous, but they're, you know, and the music isn't all that great. You know, it's all the costumes and the dancing, basically, nowadays. But if you like, and you want to see a completely fanciful presentation of Monsieur, then you can get a hold of that. All right, and he ends up finally in Paris, and eventually become la troupe du roi. So he'll have the highest patronage that you could possibly have. Now, he does a few things before 1659, but the first particularly, specifically Molièrean thing that he does is Les Précieuses Ridicules, which is to say, preciosas, females of a precious persuasion. And they're ridiculous. He's making fun of preciosity, which has been around for a long time. And these are sort of lower class, they're sort of bourgeois imitators of preciosity. So they take things to an extreme and so forth. It's a short thing, it's a slight thing, and yet it marks, I believe, something quite new in theater, probably. Maybe even absolutely, certainly in France. That is to say, maybe things like this are happening in Spain already, but in France, it is the first play that provides a kind of a picture, a portrait, and a commentary on contemporary mores. Specifically, this ideal of preciosity as practiced by people who are not very good at it, but the very best practitioners of it. So it is satirical, but it is satirical not about, human nature in general or specific types of human beings in general, but a very specific thing that is very, very current in the Paris of that day. Now, he also, before and after that, he did, Commedia dell'arte is important for him, and also farce. How should we say? Commedia dell'arte, it's hard to say whether that's a popular tradition or a literary, kind of high-level literary tradition or influence. Both in a way, I suppose. But farce is definitely popular tradition of theater, coming, in fact, from the Middle Ages. And farce, it originally meant, stuffing. Facion is to stuff. you would stuff longer plays of a different character with these comical interludes, that were little playlets in themselves. And that is a farce. And they'd be typical, and some things they do have in common with the Commedia dell'arte. They would be simple. It would often have to do with things like cuckoldry. You would have types that you'd show over and over again, such as the jealous husband. And you'd have a lot of Three Stooges kind of stuff. Well, I don't know if people know about the Three Stooges anymore, but they were people who, they hit each other a lot. There's a lot of beating. There's also a lot of mistaken identities, and people, getting hit, they're in sacks, and, you pretend like you don't know there's somebody in the sack, and you say, oh, it's a rat, I've got to kill it, and you beat on it, and so forth. And there's somebody in there who's can't reveal himself for some reason. So a lot of sort of low-level humor. Well, he practiced that a lot. He must have, in his years of wandering, he must have put on a lot of plays like that and dreamed them up. And he continued to write plays that have those elements in them. And the fascinating thing about it is that even as you go up in higher and higher level of elegance of comic art, dramatic art, he retains elements of farce, even in the most elegant and classical of his plays. So, very nice thing about him. Scannarelli is a farce. L'École des Maris is a farce. Okay, now, uh-oh. He marries this Armande Bijard, who is some... Yes, ma'am. Now, in this case, Scannarelli is in other plays, at least one of the play of him. Scannarelli is a servant. Or, in any case, in Marivaux, writing in the beginning of the 18th century, who has a lot of influence of Commedia dell'arte, he'll have Scannarelli, but he should be a valet or a domestic, something low level. Here he's... middle or lower class, middle, definitely very, very, very middle class, and he's a jealous husband. But he's certainly a figure of fun. But other cases you'll find Scannarelli is the intelligent servant. Of course, we do have a Scannarelli in Don Juan, don't we? Yes, there he's a servant, and he's not so intelligent, unfortunately. and nor is he here. Anyway, so this is, when you're getting into, the ups and downs, the controversies that this fellow was involved in. Madeleine Béjart was a member of the original troupe. And some people maintain that because this is the things that these acting people do in their troops. They don't get married. But that he had had a liaison with Madeleine Béjart. And later on, his eye fell on this other woman, whom some people said was the daughter. And then some people even farther said, she is the illegitimate daughter of the two of them. So this is an incestuous union. Well, these are all the imaginations of his opponents. The interesting thing, though, is a major theme of his plays is women having to marry people they don't want to. Women having to marry people they don't want to. And particularly, it might be the case of an old guy, certainly can't be handsome because he's old and crusty, wanting to marry a young wife. Well, in fact, that's what he did, because by this time he's 40, and she was a young thing. He could have been her father. And apparently it wasn't a happy union, as we read later. And just after that, except that it couldn't have been because of the marriage that he then gave up with L'École des Femmes. That I just don't see. But that is a case of an old guy wanting to marry a young woman. And it comes up in other plays of his. Well, that's interesting. Now, I'll point out to you, L'École des Femmes was, in a sense, in the tradition of Les Précieuses Ridicules, or it took this new tack that he had taken in the Précieuses Ridicules in talking about contemporary mores. And in this case, suggesting very definitely what you should do about it. That is to say, what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's not so good, and so forth. And this got people mad. This is where he really ran into problems with church authority for the first time. Now, we'll come back to that issue. But he wrote, for other reasons, that is to say, for questions, there are people who are objecting to it. Whenever somebody had success in Paris, there would be people to attack that person and say, this is a terrible play. It violates this and that, and so forth. Understandably, because though people liked playgoing, you had a limited audience, a limited pie from which to get slices. And so if people were going to see this guy's plays, they might not be coming to see your plays. So that's a part of it. But at any rate, there were criticisms of it from an artistic point of view, or a literary critical point of view, what you ought to do in plays. So he comes up amazingly, it seems to me, this seems something that's so very modern. The year after L'École des Femmes was produced, La Critique de l'École des Femmes, criticism of the École des Femmes, School for Women, School for Wives. And that is a little playlet that represents kind of lower class nobility, or not real high nobility, sort of in a salon type setting, where they're talking about, the latest this and that. And have you been to see this play by Molière? Yes, I think it was dreadful. And so on and so forth. And then more and more people come in, show up at this salon, and they have a general discussion about the play. And of course, eventually you have reasonable people who defend Molière, and we'll look at a text from that. Because it's a place where, now he does write prefaces to his plays, so you can find some of what his own commentary, his own thoughts about his plays in those. But also in these texts here, you find very nice presentation of how he sees what he's trying to do. Similar is L'Impromptu de Versailles. Impromptu, do we have that word in English, impromptu? We do. I think it's French. I suppose it might be originally Latin of some sort, but it's unprepared. It's totally unprepared. And so this represents Molière and his troupe, who have been called on by the king to provide an entertainment, which eventually he was doing all the time. That was a big part of his job, was to entertain the king. So, and my gosh, they don't have any time to get it ready. They have like an hour or so to prepare this play. And so he's having trouble with his cast, who are all upset. They're upset that they have so little time. They're upset with their parts, and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, he tries to push this thing through and says, here, you're playing this person. This is what this person is like. You're this other person, and so forth. And in the course of that, there are also very interesting discussion of statement of what could be taken to be his view of his activity. Okay, now, his way of responding to the attacks of a religious sort that were made on L'École des Femmes came with Tartuffe, the first version of it in 1664, which we don't possess, and it seems to have been a three-act play rather than a five-act play, and it was performed at court, as many of these plays were originally. And that got him into really hard. It's as if, okay, he resented what people had said about him, the religious critiques that were made of him in L'École des Femmes, and he decided, I'm going to go after those people in my next play. Oh, my gosh. Well, sometimes Okay, now, in fact, the king felt obliged to not let him do public performances of this play, at least not right away, because the outcry was so great. So he wasn't completely absolute, even though he was really on the side of Molière in this dispute. So he's looking around for something to do, and he just dashes off in something that he can put on in this in their theater in Paris to make some money, and he comes up with this Don Juan, based on Italian or Spanish models, plays that already existed. This is already a well-known figure. I think there had been maybe a French play or two on this topic before him. And it was something that theoretically he just dashed off. So for instance, it was written in prose. L'École des Femmes, as a sort of a really impressive comedy that it was supposed to be, was written in Alexandrian couplets, which are 12-syllable couplets. But this was just prose. Now, apparently he was thinking this isn't going to cause any trouble because, the guy is well known, his fellow who's a scofflaw, scoff faith, who ends up badly. He gets what he deserves. He goes, he's taken to hell. But somehow, certain things, the ways he presented him, or words that he put in the mouth of the character Don Juan and of his servant, Scannarelle, got people very, very upset. It is, by the way, I'll point out here, it's a very, very Baroque kind of play. Contrasting to, he follows, now things would be somewhat relaxed or a little bit different for comedy than for tragedy. Nevertheless, in his great, in really all of his comedies that I can think of, there is unity of place, unity of time, and I would say, yes, unity of action. Question of bienséance is still there, not quite in the same way. Unity of tone, presumably, and probability. But as far as the unities are concerned, and he's probably corresponding to these in some way or other, the unities are classically kept in his comedies. Don Juan, all over the place. And it's wandering, you don't know what's going to happen next. And there are characters here and characters there, and there are spurned women from a previous episode that you haven't even seen, and there are the new ones coming on, so on and so forth. And there is no, there is no logic to the progression of the action. It's just one thing after another. So why does he meet the, what does he call him? Not the Commendatoriador. He's called the Commandeur or something like that. The father of Elvira, I think, who he's killed. It comes from the grave in the form of a stone statue, of course. You know all of this. I haven't read it. Well, there's nothing exactly predicting that. And of course, it's a highly improbable thing. So it doesn't, probability doesn't include that, I must say. Okay. At any rate, it was also something that continued to get him in trouble. So he couldn't win in a certain sense. Mise en Top is another great play that we will talk about. It's one of his most very important. And finally, there's his final version of Tartuffe that was, I believe, performed publicly at least for a while, but I think probably caused people to be very upset with him. Okay, and you may know about how he died while he was playing a sick person, or an imaginary sick person, and so forth. Okay, so we can look at... maybe it's time to take a break. But let's say 15 minutes, and then we'll come back. Okay, I'm going to try to stop this.
Ooh, low battery. Oh, dear.